up on the train today that this is probably the last time I'm going to present this project before before an audience, before it goes to press, probably in 6 or 8 weeks. So this is sort of a final test run, a final chance for me to get a little bit of feedback and figure out what still needs some work. So as I was in the train, I was also reflecting on the problem, thinking about how I can summarize 500 pages in 20 minutes. It's kind of a tall order, but I thought maybe it made me think also of another train trip that I took, which was in 2008. This was in March of 2008, shortly after Obama had given his race speech in Philadelphia, and I was by happenstance also on my way to Philadelphia at the time, and that's really when the book started, as was this blog post that I wrote on the Acela headed to Philadelphia. So what I wrote about was just that I was struck by the ways in which the speech was about things other than race, that in some ways it wasn't what you would necessarily have expected a speech about race to be about at all. It wasn't at a kind of sacred site of the civil rights movement. It was at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. It didn't, in any obvious way, echo the rhetoric of King or Frederick Douglass or other folks whom you might have expected him to be evoking. Instead, he opened by quoting the first line of the preamble to the Constitution, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union." And he then went on to talk about slavery as the original sin of the Republic, and sort of talking about the history of the Republic as a kind of a long process of marching, wandering towards the promised land. So I heard that speech, I thought, aha, you know, everybody thought this is something really new. I thought, no, this is really old. This is like really, really old. And the reason I recognized this was because I had been a student of Robert Bellis when I did my PhD, and so had read his famous 1967 article on civil religion in America. I had at some point also read his kind of monograph-length treatment, The Broken Covenant. And so I saw right away that this was this kind of combination of prophetic religion and civic republicanism, which were the two threads of the civil religious tradition for Bella. So that really then was the sort of the point of departure. I mean, my initial thought was, okay, I'm just going to sort of show that this is a new version of civil religion, and I'll sort of somehow provide some historical context for Obama's rhetoric in the 2008 campaign. And this won't take me very long at all. I'll be done in 6 months or maybe a year. Obviously, things turned out very differently. Here it is. We're looking towards 2016. So one thing that happened is I realized that there were ways in which Bella's argument really needed significant revision. So two in particular I'll mention here. One was that he had really presented civil religion as a founding myth, sort of in an anthropological sense. That is, something that confers meaning, but isn't necessarily true. And he told the story of this founding myth as one of sort of erosion and decline and attenuation. The more I read, the less correct this seemed to me. It first of all seemed to me that it was better understood as a tradition than a myth, that it was something that actually had truth content, that was a way that it was sort of accumulated learning, as it were, kind of collective learning, moral and political learning, that was taken up into the tradition. And it also seemed to me that the story was not really one of just sort of erosion, decline, but of revival and re-articulation. And that a better way than talking about this was in terms of the idea of tradition than in terms of the idea of a myth. The other thing is that, you know, as I read about the debates that arose around that, particularly the 1967 article, I became convinced that he had not drawn a sharp enough boundary between what he wanted to call civil religion, what I would call religious nationalism. and that this was quite important, not because Bell himself was any kind of religious nationalist, quite the opposite, but and not simply to defend Bella's position, but also because it's a sort of an important boundary that needed to be marked, because there are ways in which civil religion can degenerate into something like religious nationalism. And it seemed to me also at the time that he had not really paid any attention to a third rival tradition, which I variously called radical secularism or liberal secularism, which was particularly a loud voice in the public square in the mid to late 2000s, you know, the rise of the new atheism and so on and so forth. So it seemed to me that to if I were going to redo the project, what I would want to do would be to kind of re-narrate civil religion as a tradition, describe its rises and falls, its recuperations and rearticulation. And then I would also want to track these other rival traditions alongside it, if not giving them quite as much attention as the central tradition of civil religion. So I've sort of thrown out these three categories. Let me then try to unpack each of them just a little bit more. And first, in just kind of conceptual or ideal typical terms, just talking about them in a very kind of static way in relationship to their textual sources and their governing metaphor. So let me start out with with civil religion. So as I suggested, by civil religion I mean a kind of a synthesis of prophetic religion and civic republicanism. I think you can disaggregate religious nationalism in a similar way into sort of two main sources. Very briefly, what I'll call premillennial apocalypticism and what I'll call the conquest narrative. And radical secularism, finally, can be, as it were, kind of decomposed into two key elements, which I would refer to total separationism and radical individualism. All right, so that's very schematic. Let me just kind of elaborate all of that a little bit by means of a couple of series of kind of contrasts. And I'll start by by contrasting prophetic religion with apocalypticism and the conquest narrative. So when I talk about prophetic religion, what I really mean is a certain strand within the Jewish Bible, that Jewish scriptures, that's held together by the metaphor of covenant, and something that, of course, turns up in the Mosaic text, and is very central to what Old Testament scholars call the later prophets. by which I mean Jeremiah, Ezekiel, so on and so forth. And central to this idea is this idea of a religious and political community which is held together by its commitment to some set of higher values, which have to be continually re-examined and re-articulated. So the covenant is not something that's made once for all time, but is something which is made and remade, and from which the people are continually straying and continually need to be called back. So that's what I mean by prophetic religion. Now, of course, you say prophetic religion nowadays, oftentimes, surely not here, but in many contexts, people confuse this with what I would call prophecy belief. By prophecy belief, I simply mean, kind of forecasts of the end times based on certain readings of Daniel, and of course, especially the apocalypse of John, right? And so these scriptures are then read in a kind of a, as if they contain coded predictions about future events, as if the world fell into a series of sort of dispensations or stages to which certain people hold a kind of a skeleton key, and the final stage of which will be some kind of apocalyptic struggle of supernatural forces, a final battle between good and evil. This is, in fact, a relatively new, by my reading, interpretation of Scripture, certainly not one that becomes the predominant one within American Protestantism until at least the early 20th century, 1920s, 1930s. despite its claims to being an older orthodoxy, it's actually, in my view, kind of a new heterodoxy. The conquest narrative. By this I mean an understanding of the Jewish mission as one of sort of conquest of the promised land. And this is a metaphor, the conquest narrative is really held together by the metaphor of blood. So blood conquest, blood sacrifice, blood belonging, right? Blood is the thing which ties people, land, and state together. So these are, all very different readings of a set of interconnected scriptures. Let me then say a little bit about civic republicanism. So if you ask people what kind of country is the United States, if we were to sort of walk up to Commonwealth Avenue and ask people by that question, they would say, well, it's a democracy. Maybe they say it's a liberal democracy. They would say it's a constitutional democracy. Not that many people would say that it's a republic. And some of the people who would say it was probably wouldn't really understand very well what that term meant, at least to the founders and well up through the 19th century. And it is sort of confusing because the sort of central terms of civic republicanism are also terms that are taken over within a certain form of classical liberalism, but given very different meanings. And let me just give you a couple of very quick examples of how different these meanings are. So, first of all, freedom. Certainly, nobody would dispute that that's a central part of a central value in the American tradition. So, again, if we're asking the person up on Commonwealth Avenue, what do you understand by freedom? I think a lot of people would say, well, it's doing whatever I want to do. It's not having somebody stop me from doing what I want to do. It's making my own choices. Philosophically, what it means is it means a sort of lack of absence of external constraints on our physical motion. This is radically different from the way in which freedom is understood in the civic republican tradition. There it's understood, first of all, as self-mastery. That is, not simply following whatever our impulses are, but actually having some sort of rational control over our impulses and desires. It also means being part of a particular kind of community. A person cannot be fully free unless they're part of a free state. And finally, it means not being dominated by the arbitrary will of other persons. So it's a much more complex understanding of freedom, which in many ways is really contrasts sharply with the kind of the liberal, whatever I want to do version of freedom. How about virtue? Virtue, again, I think if you ask people, it has these sort of narrowly sexual connotations for many people nowadays. Whereas, it's really a sort of a central moral, ethical category, right, within the civic republican tradition. And one of the most important connotations it has is the idea that that a free state can't persist without some measure of civic virtue, right? That you can have the best institutions in the world, the prices can be right, The institutional architecture can be perfect, and still, without a certain measure of civic virtue, and ultimately you're going to wind up with some form of corruption or tyranny. This is, again, a radical contrast with the typical sort of liberal, classical liberal idea, which is that all you need to do is get the institutional architecture right, all you need to do is get the prices right. Once the machinery is built properly, in Kant's phrase, you can govern a population of devils, right? So that's another big contrast. The last one that I'll draw concerns the nature of the good, right? So the good within the civic republican tradition is a kind of a naturalistic concept, right? I mean, human beings are creatures who falter and flourish under certain circumstances, and they just are the way that they are. Certain kinds of activity is important for their well-being. Whereas the good in the liberal tradition is understood as completely subjective. It's just, whatever floats your boat, whatever makes you happy, whatever you're into, it's completely subjective. So again, a relatively sharp contrast, I think, with the civic republican tradition. And so finally, and I'll come to an end with the concept mongering pretty soon here. Finally, let me draw a contrast between total separationism, civil religion, and religious nationalism. So by total separationism, I simply mean the idea that that religion and politics must have absolutely nothing to do with one another. They must be kept completely separate from one another. And this doesn't just mean that, the state can't fund church activities or appoint religious officials. It means, for example, that religious speech, religious discourse should be kept out of the public square, that there should be no flow of symbols or people or ideas or bodies or anything between the political and religious spheres. At the other end of the spectrum, you have what I would call kind of fusionism, which is the idea that you really can't be fully part of the polity unless you're a particular kind of person. So this is the idea that can a Jew be an American? Maybe we kind of admitted them to this halfway covenant. Catholics are maybe okay. Atheists definitely not. Muslims stay far away, right? So this is the idea that that your religious faith is a kind of a proxy for ethnic identity, and you can't really be civically included unless you're a particular kind of person of faith. So I see the sort of middle tradition, the civil religious tradition, as one that sees an inevitable and sometimes productive overlap between the religious and political spheres. We just can't keep the two things separate. I mean, even the most secular progressive has what looked to a religious person like metaphysical commitments that sort of transcend any kind of self-interest. And certainly any religious person, at least one who comes out of any of the kind of monotheistic tradition, is going to have certain kinds of ethical and political values that flow out of their religious commitments. They're inevitably going to influence their politics and may speak religion in religious terms their first language. To say that they can't use religious terms in public life is in a way to force them to speak a second language, which may not be their native tongue, right? So for all of these reasons, I think that there is a potential, that there's inevitable overlap, but also possibly a productive tension between the religious and the political spheres. Okay, so hopefully this is now making it a little bit clearer what I mean by these three different political theologies or traditions, right? So remember I said civil religion is civic republicanism plus prophetic religion, religious nationalism is is the conquest narrative plus premillennial apocalypticism, and radical secularism is radical individualism or liberal individualism plus total separationism. And so I see these as having been sort of three competing political theologies that have shaped our public life now for quite a long time. So how long? Let me now try to give a little historical depth here. So I see the civil religious tradition is one that that really goes all the way back to the New England Puritan, right? For whom covenant and prophetic religion is absolutely central. They're already thinking in a kind of a proto-civic republican way, and certainly by the time of the American Revolution, there's been almost a complete fusion of these two traditions. You know, as there's been a more kind of self-conscious recovery of ancient forms of civic republicanism by the revolutionary and pre-revolutionary generation. And the history of this tradition then really is one of greater and greater inclusion, right? So the republic is initially understood to be constituted by free, white, property-holding males, much of the struggle over the tradition is a way of recasting it in a way that will first include African-American men, will then include women, and then, you know, will more fully include others as well. We were talking earlier today about the way in which gays and lesbians now, the marriage equality involves a fuller form of civic inclusion based on these central values of equality. Religious nationalism in the United States is also very, very old. I mean, I actually find its roots already in the wars of the New England colonists against the Native Americans. See the sort of the first rumblings of this, sort of casting Native Americans as sort of demons and devils, imagining that these wars are actually kind of also apocalyptic struggles of one kind or another. But it doesn't really come into full flower again until the early 20th century, and there are various reasons for this. I mean, one I've already noted is that this kind of apocalyptic rhetoric does not really become widespread amongst American Protestants until the 20s or 30s. But I think it also has a great deal to do with the World Wars and with the Cold War. There had been a very long-standing suspicion of military establishments and standing armies in the United States that was alive until certainly World War II. I mean, very rapid demobilization after the World Wars was particularly after World War I, was deeply informed by the suspicion of standing armies. And it's really only through kind of a very self-conscious, top-down rhetorical campaign that Americans are convinced that America has been this sort of armed, militarized nation from time immemorial. I would argue, as far as radical secularism goes, that this is actually a very new tradition. The idea of total separation, on my reading, doesn't really emerge until the 1870s, the 1880s. And sort of libertarian understandings of liberty, kind of radical individualistic understandings, don't emerge really full flower until a couple decades after that. So people who argue that radical secularism is sort of the founding tradition, that it's already in the Constitution, that it was the intention of Jefferson and Madison, I think, are involved in a radical misreading of those documents and trying to kind of give put a revolutionary mantle on a 20th century tradition. Okay, so let me then shift very briefly to kind of a normative vein, and then I'll wrap up because I know I'm going a little bit long here already. So why do I, it should be obvious that I think the civil religious tradition is the most defensible of the three, the only one of those three that really fully deserves our affirmation. Why do I think that? So I think there are sort of three ways in which you can make this argument. One has to do with their sort of internal coherence of the three traditions. One has to do with the historical accuracy of the three traditions, and the third is with what I'll call their sociological plausibility. So I find both radical secularism and religious nationalism be internally incoherent. That is, they're contradictory in terms of their own values. Radical secularism is self-contradictory because it's illiberal. It involves placing certain kinds of discursive restrictions on religious co-citizens. Religious nationalism is self-contradictory because it's irreligious. It's, at the end of the day, a form of national self-worship, idolatry, in brief. Whereas civic republicanism, or civil religion, I think coheres internally. There's also the question of historical accuracy. I think that on purely historical grounds, that if one looks at the sort of two founding moments in of the American Republic, New England Puritanism and the American Revolution, that one finds these prophetic religion, civic republicanism, commanding the majority, you know, really dominating public discourse and the nation's self-understanding during both of these founding moments, and remains central well into the 20th century. I've already said I don't think radical secularism really has any title to being a founding tradition. It's a kind of a late add-on, and even religious nationalism is something I think that really doesn't come into full flower until the early 20th century. The final criterion, as I said, is sociological plausibility. So I think the kind of radical secularist notion that we can remove religion from the public square is one that simply is implausible for people who are as metaphysical as the Americans. And I use metaphysical in this broad sense to encompass people who are spiritual or even think of themselves as secular in some sense. I don't think that that one can sort of wash that out of the American tradition. Religious nationalism strikes me as sociologically implausible because we're too diverse a people to be unified around a single creed or a single ethnicity. What we need is some form of civic membership which is based on shared traditions and values, and that's precisely what the civil religious tradition provides. So finally, just sort of wrapping up, whither the civil religious tradition? What would be my diagnosis? Well, not as rosy as it was in 2008, certainly. Not as hopeful as it was in 2008, and for two reasons. The first is that I don't think that the professional political class are trustworthy custodians of that tradition. They're driven by their own ambitions and driven by the party system in the direction of increasing polarization of the public. And so if there are going to be custodians of this tradition, people are going to defend it and re-articulate it, those people are going to be in civil society. They're not going to be have both feet in political life. They may have allies in the political class, hopefully they do, who will be spokespeople for them. But if this tradition is really going to get recuperated at all, it's going to be through the work of people in civil society. The second big lesson I think that's hit home to me is that that the Republican leg is definitely the weaker of the two. You see that, the prophetic tradition is still alive and well. That speech, the resonance that it had, made that clear again to me once again. But the civic Republican tradition is weak. And that's unfortunate because I think in many ways it provides a much more accurate diagnosis of our ills than its rival traditions do. I mean, the religious nationalist diagnosis would basically be, too much diversity, not enough war, or something like that, right? And the radical secularist tradition would be, in the radical secularist diagnosis would be, oh, you know, we're just letting too much kind of morality influence our politics. You know, we just have to sort of cut deals, let markets do the work. I think it's fairly clear, at least to me, that those solutions have both been tried over the last few decades and found pretty serious and wanting. I mean, the kinds of problems that we're facing right now are really severe. You know, anybody who thinks that America is number one in anything except military spending right now needs to get out of town a little bit more, I would say. And I don't think that the kinds of problems that we have are soluble without reconstituting some sort of a vital center, some sort of space of sort of shared values and dialogue that allow people to actually have arguments instead of just having shouting matches. And I do think that the civil religious tradition and the civic republican thread are part of overcoming those problems. So I'll stop. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Well, I think we might be able to find a few things to discuss now, right? Maybe? So I'd love to open it up for questions. Would anybody like to start, or should I start? Somebody have a pressing question they would like to ask? Don.
Could you add some reflections? Sorry, Dominic Doyle, I teach at the School of Theology and Ministry. Do you think the Catholic Church fits this model of the imbalance tilting towards the prophetic rather than the civil religion? I think of things like the contraception mandate and virtue construed narrowly in terms of sexuality. Do you think the Catholic Church, which maybe has the intellectual resources to articulate this civic Republican tradition, has bought into this imbalance towards the prophetic model?
I actually do see the Catholic Church as increasingly central. In the sense that it's the only religious community, I think, in the United States which is sort of large enough in position and a sort of centrist in that fashion, and which has the kind of intellectual depth to really anchor the civil religious tradition. I think, in particular, it's probably the only religious community where these civic Republican ideas, or links to the civic Republican ideas, are still very much alive within the theological conversation. I mean, in terms of the meaning of the prophetic, I mean, I think you know, these are things that we can have, you know, we can actually debate. I mean, I don't think that, you know, people who are you know, concerned about birth control or you know, abortion are you know, people who are sort of being automatic, uncivil, or, you know, ruled out of court, or that this is something which is completely outside of the prophetic tradition. I mean, obviously, concern for life, concern for families, is something which is incredibly important. I think, in particular, insofar as it's also counterbalanced by this central concern for the common good and for human flourishing that you still find, you know, with some real kind of intellectual resources behind it within the Catholic tradition. So, you know, I actually see in some ways that Catholic Church probably is, you know, the community that could, you know, most anchor this revival of this tradition. I don't know if that really was the question you were asking. Yeah.
Well, I wonder, you mentioned Bella's 1968 essay, or 67, 66, 68, whatever it was. I'm also wondering about another big piece in that era by Martin Marty, who talked about priestly and prophetic civil religions. Are you assigning the priestly civil religion to religious nationalism, or do you see it as being something different? Because in his case, it has salutary aspects to it, where it's a mode of, you know, civil religion that endorses authority, that helps legitimate government. And so we say, God bless America, and that helps us understand that America means something, or that we're a nation under God, and that helps us feel under an obligation to do something proper. These are the sort of priestly aspects of it. And the prophetic, he would separate out as the ones that call us back to our principles, right? And so the things like abortion would fit under the prophetic know, anti-abortion movements would be prophetic in nature, or or sometimes social justice movements that call us back. So I'm wondering if you don't see that as a relevant distinction, or whether you're putting the priestly mode into religious nationalism, or what?
That's a really good point. I mean, this is this Marty essay, something I read very, very early on. It's kind of, you know, receded to the back of my mind after that. So that's something that I probably should revisit. It is a helpful distinction, because it is true that presidents in particular, and political officials more generally, often are called on to play this priestly role, and that certainly is important to the civil religious tradition, but it is probably a little closer to the slippery slope down towards religious nationalism, right? I mean, for me, the kind of the dividing line or the litmus test, if you will, is the appearance of this kind of, you know, Manichaean rhetoric, apocalyptic rhetoric, exonerating Americans of all of their sins and proclaiming them the greatest nation on earth, by definition. I think that as long as it's this sort of priestly impulse is always, you know, paired with or counterbalanced by this kind of prophetic reflection, it's okay. But the one without the other is definitely quite dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, the image behind you is Obama in Charleston, right? And so that's a really interesting case of, I think, both, where he's called upon to be our national priest to preside at a funeral, essentially, right? That's civic and religious in nature. And yet he used the opportunity to make a pretty strong prophetic call for racial justice and things. And that's an interesting tension you don't always see that can be different in different times.
I mean, it's even interesting, and I hadn't really thought about it this way, right? But if you sort of think about his public appearances, I mean, he does switch between these two roles. I mean, there were homily delivered in Ebenezer Baptist Church during the 2000s.
Birmingham.
Yeah, or Birmingham, right.
Yeah.
And then there's this where he's, you know, clearly in a religious space, and his rhetoric is slightly different. He's of course a kind of a master code switcher, but I mean here he's much more in the black preacher mode, mm-hmm. right? Even though that sort of comes into some of his political speech as well, depending on who he's talking to.
No? My sense is that civic religion died when the Constitution was written, and in particular in Federalist 51, when Madison said ambition must be made to carry on pushing it. Wouldn't ambition be a sin in the civic republican tradition of putting the self-interest before the virtue of the common good? And if that's the case, then Madison, by saying that sin can counteract sin, is sort of doubling things that would be anathema to the civic republican tradition. It's kind of like it's almost as if he's saying, I know virtue won't work. So he's taking a Calvinist, you know, kind of sense that we need some.
Yeah, I think that passage can be read in different ways. I know that it's often read in the way that you're saying, right, as a sort of bridge from, kind of a hardcore, you know, hyper-Augustinian Calvinism that doesn't place a lot of faith in human nature, mm-hmm. towards a kind of secular liberalism that places a great deal of faith in the counterbalancing of self-interest and institutions. I would read that in a slightly different way, or at least I think there is a different way that you can read it that situates it within the Republican tradition, which is that the Republican tradition always sees the necessity of balancing power against power. And this is, you know, classically speaking, of the power of the one, the few, and the many, right? Which is understood also, not just institutionally, but sociologically, right? These are not just institutions that are being counterbalanced against one another in a division of powers, but these are also groups that are being counterbalanced against one another. You can hear echoes of this as late as, you know, Dewey, basically, is saying the same thing. He says, you know, we have to sort of reinvent liberalism. The state has to be able to counterbalance against business. Otherwise, business will become a new source of tyranny. So I think there's a kind of a Republican reading of that as well, it doesn't dispense with the need for virtue, but it also doesn't place all the chips on virtue either.
And one other thing. Wouldn't you need a nation to have religious nationalism? And you mentioned that there are two foundings, but I think there are three, and the 14th Amendment is the third. So I was really struck by the absence of talk about the South and the North and how hard it actually was to create a nation, a unified nation.
Sure, sure. And I, you know, my Civil War chapter is,
oh,
you know, it's called the Refounding.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right that you have to see that as a, mm-hmm. you know, as a refounding. I mean, it really was this radical struggle about the meaning of the Republic, and in particular the meaning of that, of the preamble to the Declaration and its relationship to the preamble to the Constitution. Do the aspirational value, sort of two debates. I mean, one does the Declaration frame the Constitution, or does the Constitution supersede the Declaration? That's the first argument. And the second argument is, do the aspirations and the preambles trump the fine print in the Articles, or the reverse? And the argument that wins the day is that the Declaration frames the Constitution and the preambles frame the Articles. And that argument is not over.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that's for sure. I mean, the people holding up their pocket constitutions mm-hmm. and citing chapter and verse, or, people who talk openly about rescinding the 14th, 15th, and 16th Amendments is a huge mistake. And they're around. I mean, one of them's running for president right now. So...
It seems to me that Spinoza's idea, where you have Hobbes establishing religion, Locke having a qualified toleration, but Spinoza just radically saying, let them all say what they want to say and they'll cancel each other out, and you'll have neutral platitudes. But in fact, it seems like you're probably going to mention this in your Civil War chapter, that the great American civil religious person was Lincoln, the Gettysburg Address and so forth and so on. And it seems to me that probably religious people aren't going to be, I mean, in other words, Catholic kids now are like everybody else, saying, isn't religion a problem in the world today? The ones I meet here in 71, in contrast to the ones I met in 71, they're much more willing to say that, and therefore separate themselves as spiritual from religious and so forth and so on. So I was just wondering how you think about that, with that kind of neutral, not so really seriously religious, but platitudinous and ideal, holding up ideals, would that be what might last?
I think from a, I mean, now looking at this from a political as opposed to a theological perspective, I mean, certainly some degree of tolerance and forbearance are important civic virtues and the incredibly diverse democratic society that we live in. I mean, my only concern is that those become the only virtues, the ones that trump everything else. And as long as you're tolerant, and which is to say, as long as you don't really care what anybody else says or does, that's enough. That I certainly disagree with. I mean, I think that kind of, you want to sort of hold your commitments somewhat loosely, but you don't want to just sort of drop them, at the first opportunity. So I think those, that it's difficult task to balance forbearance with engagement, but I think that is sort of the task that that we're called to as citizens of a really diverse democracy.
So where does political correctness fit?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really good question. You know, I do think that there are times where, you know, the people who are critical of political correctness, I mean, you know, their values and their is kind of an attitude. And I think that oftentimes the values are commendable ones, and sometimes the attitude is problematic. So, you know, the kind of political correctness involved, shouting other people down, or saying so-and-so should never ever speak on my campus, or you know, just sort of refusing to engage people at all, you know, who share different values than oneself because one's so certain about the correctness of one's own views. You know, the sins of youth and all that, but that's the problem.
Into your polarization.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's
because both sides say that error is
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, just a little, at the close of your talk, you're talking about we have to sort of reconstitute some sort of center where, presumably, to have a civil religion, you have to have civil discourse, and it seems that. At least in my adulthood, I've seen anything resembling civil discourse sort of dissolve. Related to that, in your title, it says, you know, the culture wars, which you didn't get into too much. I'm a citizen. That's my identification now. And I don't really identify so much with politics, but I'm much more concerned with culture because I think, you know, I'm a father of four adult kids and I have a couple grandkids. Looking at how much the prevailing culture, consumer materialist culture, shapes values more than institutions like political and religious institutions. And so if one were to do some sort of phenomenological analysis of culture and how it had arisen and how many different cultures there are, which wind up, while they may have their roots in certain political ideologies or religious ideologies, still, they come a lot from a mass consumer society, and I just wonder how you factor that mass culture aspect promulgated by kind of invisible people in Madison Avenue and everywhere else factors into those paradigms that you set forth.
Right. So I think that is a problem that has to be addressed initially at the level of the culture, right? That people confusing, you know, the good with goods. People imagining that our collective well-being is basically captured by GDP. That is a huge problem. I think, the sort of civic Republican tradition says, you know, one of the two great sociological sources of the corruption of a republic are inequality and the love of luxury, which doesn't seem to, you know, seems still pretty true to me, pretty accurate diagnosis of you know, what ails us at the moment. And you know, I'm not unhopeful about that. I mean, it certainly is true that there are an awful lot of really kind of shallow materialistic young people and old people. But, you know, sort of the younger generation, I also see, you know, people spending less money on stuff and more time and money on experiences, relationships. I mean, that I see as a potentially promising development. I mean, this is just sort of anecdotal, right? I mean, just, you know, kids I know and interact with. But, I mean, I do think that there is a, you know, certain satiety among some segments of the younger generation with this stuff. And so, you know, that's what I'm hoping, anyway.
You said that it was up to kind of civil society to bring back civic republicanism. But it seems to me, I mean, your most prominent examples were related to President Obama, who actually has this mass pulpit. Like, literally, whenever he talks, he can reach millions and millions of people. So I'm just trying to understand. He was your most prominent example that I saw, but do you have any examples of people today who are kind of articulating a need to go back to civic republicanism, or is it more hopeful for this next generation?
You know, I'd be happy to hear names of folks. You know, I think that, you know, maybe I'm just tilting at windmills with this, right? There's been a lot of talk in academic circles about recovering civic republicanism and the civic republican tradition in the U.S. But it's, you know, it's not entirely easy for it to get traction. That said, there are, you know, just a couple of things that I've noticed recently that I think are quite interesting is that people are talking about oligarchy again. Yeah. That's different than talking about inequality. I mean, it's not to say that, you know, that the fundamental problem is just a distributional one, right? That it's an economic one. It's sort of connecting that up with the sort of state of the republic. And so I see some of this republican language finding its way back into public discourse again. I can point to sort of academics who are, Zephyr Teachout. I don't know if anybody read her book. She has this beautiful book on corruption, beautifully written book on corruption.
Can you say the name of the
book? Yeah, what's
Zephyr Teachout? What a name.
Yeah.
Zephyr Teachout. And Teachout spelled just like teach and out.
Long book. Well, that's the title of the book.
It's just like corruption from Benjamin Franklin's snuff box to, I mean, if you just put in Zephyr Teachout,
I'll take you straight
to the book. Yeah.
Gave Andrew Cuomo a run for his money. And
exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Governor, yeah.
Governor.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Wilbur, Timothy Wilbur.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say that the possibility of a national conversation has become so much harder because we no longer watch the same television, and we don't read papers that are just, you know, papers. There's just so many other avenues. We get our versions of truth or truthiness, however you want to define it, in your own circles, and you just do not accept anything outside of it. Would you say that that's really exacerbated the problem?
I think it has, for sure, and it's not 100%. It's not at all clear to me, you know, what you could do to counteract that. You know, how could you create the space for some sort of broader national conversation? I mean, I guess that's why, you know, for example, the
president remains
more. Right, president and people like that in positions of leadership, do remain really, really important because, you know, they can initiate a conversation that a lot of people then join into on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, so wherever they hang out, in the social media landscape. But it's true, there has just been this tremendous fragmentation of the culture that, you know, in part just driven by technology.
It's also what the civic Republican Christopher Lash called a culture of noise.
Right.
You know, and you couldn't find a more anti-civic Republican person in the world than Donald Trump. The great notion. I mean, every single thing associated with this tradition, he represents the opposite.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of, I suppose I was joking earlier, you know, although it's all kind of sad, that I was like a little bit worried, given how long it took me to complete the book, that it would somehow be relevant, but I don't think so.
No, it definitely won't.
No, definitely won't be.
And I think Stephen Colbert makes a really interesting counterpoint to Trump because
I was going to mention him as a possible.
He's played the narcissist for 9 years, and now he's not. And how he's introducing these civil Republican ideas on the Late Show of all places—crazy.
And Catholic.
And very devout Catholic.
I do hear that the phrase common good more and human flourishing. That's mm-hmm. another phrase I hear a lot more now than I heard 10 years ago. So, and those are terms that do come out of this tradition.
I guess I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts on civic education would be. I'm a doctoral student in the School of Education, so I'm really interested in middle and high school education. But what can we do at that level to instill kind of these civic Republican ideas and the skills necessary for the civic discourse that's kind of missing?
Oh gosh, I would be super interested. I bet you have some thoughts about that. So after I give my answer, I'd be really interested to hear what thoughts you might have. I mean, I do think that there has been a little bit of a failure of nerve amongst the American educated classes. I mean, I understand. You know, in some ways, it's well intentioned. The idea that it would somehow be colonialist or authoritarian to engage in any kind of project of, Americanization, as it used to be called. But I think, as salutary as that is in some ways, as a recognition of the incredible diversity of America, I think that, what it has done in a way is it sort of left this vacuum, which then gets filled by this kind of hyper-patriotic, kind of nationalistic, chauvinistic, basically kind of imperialistic rhetoric. So, if you kick out the good angels, the bad ones are going to run in. So I think that's, I don't know what you would or could do in terms of actual reform in public school curricula. I mean, I really don't know. I mean, I'll tell you one of my other hobby horse would be national service. I think that would be a great thing. I think actually there would certainly be lots of opposition, but I think that there would, I think there would be a lot of young people who would love that. And that it would be good for the country in a lot of ways. Again, I spent the spring in Singapore, which has its own problems, but kind of civic solidarity and public civility are not one of those, those are not problems there. And I think it does have a little bit to do with this national service program that they have, which is, a lot of it's military, but not exclusively. And that's sort of the vision that I would have of what it would mean. It would be, there would be various ways that you could do it, but whatever, you could serve in the military, but a lot of it would be, and it wouldn't just be doing sort of service work, it would be like building stuff, where there would be something that you had contributed to building, that, something physical, something real, that would be there 50 years later, as you look back. I mean, I think that would be great. So again, I can see, would widespread panic in the helicopter parents set, right? But still, I think it would be a great thing.
Do you think that would be, I like the idea of national service for lots of reasons also. It had attraction in the 90s, and early 2000s even. But wouldn't the cluster of people who see the common good as necessarily ground up instead of top down, the ones who worry about totalitarianism or a centralized notion of the common good, wouldn't those people see national service as statist? I mean, as being all of a sudden we triple the size of our coffers and force everyone to work on projects the government wants, et cetera? Would that defeat the concept?
Yeah, I think it would. So, I haven't, I'm not like a policy guy really, but it's just sort of thinking out loud about this, I totally agree with you, and I think the only way that this would or could work in an American context is if there were some way in which a lot of the work percolated up from the bottom, so that, it would be possible for people to sort of start projects, and then, it work, the way that a lot of stuff works in this interface between the public and private sectors in the U.S. People would propose a particular project, and then the government would somehow sort of approve this and sort of provide funding for, the kids who actually participated in the project. Something like that, I think, is how it would have to work. And that would have to be understood fairly broadly. I mean, I think it would have to be possible for, you know, kind of civic and religious organizations to come up with projects as well. I don't think it could just be like local government or something like that, or schools. But that might be one way of doing it. I mean, the only, you know, the downside of that, of course, is just that, you know, you, if it gets too balkanized, I mean, part of the benefit of this would just be that it brings people, very diverse groups of people together for a couple of years, you know, the way that the military does. So I guess, you know, you'd have to sort of think about counterbalancing that, but I think that would be, you know, we're all already also so sort of geographically segregated at this point. I mean, more so than we were 30 or 40 years ago, some demographers tell us. So this would be a way of counteracting that to some degree.
It's a great project. Can't wait to read it.
Yeah. Can't wait for it to be
published. Well, join me in thanking Dr. Gorski for coming and speaking to us today. Thanks for being so gracious and answering our questions. Hang out for a few minutes in case anybody wants to say anything more.
Yep.